Today's program is brought to you by Tabard Inn, new American cuisine in one of Washington, D.C.'s oldest hotels, located in DuPont Circle. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to The Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is author and journalist John Bonnet. We'll talk to John about his new book, The New Wine Rules, a genuinely helpful guide to everything you need to know. Instead of our weekly wine sip this week, we'll speak with Stephen Bitteroff from Riesling Fair in New York City for a few minutes. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. John Bonnet is an award-winning author and journalist. He is a senior contributing editor for Punch, an online magazine featuring wine, spirits, beer, and cocktails. He is the former wine editor of the San Francisco Chronicle. John is the author of The New Wine Rules, his current book, and The New California Wine. He's working on his next book, The New French Wine. John currently lives in New York City, but he's been spending a heck of a lot of time in France. I could tell from your Instagrams.
Quite a lot.
Yes. John, welcome back to the show. It's great to have you.
It's great to see you, Sam.
And on a side note, this is the first show of our new season, and it's great to kick it off with John. All right, John, let's get right into the book and a whole bunch of things. So you've written countless articles in print, online. You wrote a book about California, and you're working on a new one about French wine. What compelled you to write an everything you need to know guide to wine, or however you would describe the genre? Because your books are pretty intense, and this is too, but it's different.
The genre of book that I swore I would never write, and it certainly doesn't need another added to it. There were a few things. What really triggered it was my wife and I were having lunch at a restaurant in San Francisco, a pretty well-known one with a great wine list, and we're sitting there, and she's a wine importer and distributor, and she
very knowledgeable.
Knows a lot more than I do. So we're sitting there, and we're watching this table of obviously professional, very successful women, late 20s, early 30s, and they're sort of there. They're struggling to get through the wine list. They're not getting a lot of help. And this started a conversation between us where we said, you know, this isn't like super basic. These are folks who are obviously really accomplished, and it's not that they don't want to know more about wine. They're not stuck in like a Pinot Grigio hole. They're curious, but no one has given them real useful guidance. And I knew enough about the universe of most basic wine books out there to not love most of the ones that had been produced to date. And I felt like they all kind of go through this paint-by-numbers thing of, well, here's Merlot, and here's Sauvignon Blanc, and here's Chianti and Bordeaux and whatever. It's this taxonomy of wine that's like 40, 50 years old and doesn't really apply if you go to the top restaurants now and look for wines to drink. You could have read a lot of, you know, sort of introductory wine stuff and feel like you were drowning. And so this started a conversation saying, you know, I've now done this 15 years or so. I've obviously written a lot. I write, usually, like you said, at a pretty high level and lose a lot of people along the way, many, if not most of them. And, you know, I'm comfortable with my knowledge and my expertise and where I write, but at the same time, is there some way that I can take kind of the way that I think about wine, you know, if the mapping of my brain, my wine brain, and put it out in a book that tries to do this sort of important task for the wine industry in a totally different way. And then we started talking about it with Ten Speed, which is my publisher, and they had some ideas and some thoughts, and I did too, and we ended up with an amazing illustrator, Maria Hergetta, who does most of my column illustrations.
Beautiful
Punch.
Illustration.
Yeah, she did such an extraordinary job. And Ten Speed's really amazing designer, and I felt that we got this unique opportunity to go at, again, a really important task in a totally different way.
So if you could, when you're looking at those women at that restaurant, if you can get the book now in their hands, then they would have felt more comfortable.
Maybe.
In the room, maybe.
Maybe.
Certainly. I think so. I mean, I read the book,
yeah,
so I think yeah. That's where you were going.
I think, you know, like there's a lot of Rieslings on that list, and I think that they would have felt maybe more comfortable about the idea that there was wine with maybe a tiny bit of sweetness, but not something that was going to degrade their drinking experience, not something that was going to come across as, oh, you're drinking sweet wine, so it can't be good.
Right.
So, yes, hopefully there were a few rules out of that would have been useful.
So the book is broken down in 8 different sections, and you lay down 89 rules, if I counted them correctly.
89.
Why not an even number, 88, and why not 90? We'll talk about that another time. All right, so that's the way the book is. 8 different sections, you know, with different specialties, and there's rules that roll on to the end.
Yeah.
All right, so let's get into it. The first thing, which I thought was very interesting, is it was a sort of a very simplistic thing, and I want you to expand on it. You say 2 things, drink with joy, nice thing to say, and drink the rainbow.
Yeah.
Talk to me about, you know, what you mean.
Sure. I mean, drink with joy is, I wouldn't say it's self-evident because it's endlessly complex, but I think the idea was that what that comes from, both in the introduction and in Drink the Rainbow, which is rule number one, and it's rule number one because it's my favorite, I'll be honest, is that so much of, again, the past few decades, really generationally, so much of the growth of the modern American wine industry has been based on consumers who act out of fear. They don't wander, they're not exploratory, and this isn't I'm not saying this prejudicially. This isn't sort of throwing shade on people for not being more curious. I think there's good reason that people aren't more curious, or I should say haven't been more curious. And if you look at the psychographic studies that even big wine companies do, they're very clear that, you know, maybe 20-30% of the population, of the wine drinking population, is going to wander a little bit in their choices, but so much of the past, you know, half century in wine in this country, which is when wine became a household thing, was driven out of fear. People drank Chardonnay, they stuck with Chardonnay. Maybe if you were really lucky, you could get them to switch to Pinot Grigio. Maybe if you made a movie about Pinot Noir, you might get everyone to dump Merlot and go drink Pinot instead. But there were just, tectonically, people stayed in their hole. And so Drink with Joy was, more than anything, and Drink the Rainbow too, which I'll get to in a sec, was saying, you know, let's put that in the past, and let's acknowledge that there's this world out there that's curious, and once you get past the fact that there are some gatekeepers who don't want to make it easy for you to gain not expert knowledge, but just enough knowledge to feel okay navigating, that there's so many interesting things out there. There's so many interesting flavors. There's so many interesting producers and regions. And the idea that you should drink wine out of a sense of sort of loyalty and timidity just doesn't work anymore. Which takes us to Drink the Rainbow. And the idea there was, you know, again, you have this taxonomy of wine. We see it on wine lists. We see it in stores. Whatever, you have red, you have white, maybe you have some bubbles. But it's all put into buckets. And the idea of Drink the Rainbow is basically taking Eat the Rainbow, which I was looking at a lot of health books when I was trying to put together the outline for this, and say, you know, in the world of wine, the same thing should apply. There's too much diversity now. There's orange wines. There's sherries and all sorts of oxidative process wines. There's amphorae. There's, you know, all shades of rosé. There's Pet Nat. There's so many different ways that there's so many different forms of wine versus like the three old buckets that you have to think of it on a continuum, or I guess a spectrum, which of course is a rainbow. And so it became this idea of saying, you know, stop thinking I got to have a red, I got to have a white, and just be curious enough to say, well, you know, maybe I can look for the things in between the old categories.
Right. And I may be jumping ahead, but two of the ways you talk about that in the book is to befriend a local wine guy at a good store, and he'll help you explore the rainbow. And sommeliers, which could be a whole nother subject, who they are, where they're at today. But most of them are there to serve you. If you ask them for interesting things, they'll explore and show you the rainbow.
Yeah, and I think there's a fear factor there, maybe even more so with retail, because people typically, it takes a lot to get people into a small local wine shop. And especially in New York, it's kind of a roll of the dice. There's amazing shops, but there's also, I mean, because of the licensing,
right,
there's a lot of basically vodka shops, yeah, with some wine.
Right.
So it's like, it's like finding a good independent bookstore. It's finding someone who wants to help you on the journey and, you know, as a side benefit might make some money for
it. I think that's an important relationship. And certainly New York houses enough of those places.
Yeah.
I think you talk about value and quality a lot in the book. You know, when you talk about value, you don't necessarily mean cheap, but, you know, there are good wines at good prices. I have a bunch of questions I want to talk to you about that. You say that white wine is the best value. Why?
It usually is. Mostly because, well, one, it's people just typically, unless you're a real Burgundy hound.
Right, a Montrachet guy or something.
Unless you're doing Polignac on the daily.
Right.
Typically people won't pay as much for white wine, and so people have started to think that it's a simpler wine, which I don't tend to believe. It's just, it doesn't, I mean, some of it is just very practical. It doesn't require as much money or time in production, typically
cheaper to make.
Yeah,
you lower can, price to sell.
Yeah, well, you can do it. You can do it without barrels. You don't have to age it necessarily as long. You can, but the production is a little less cost intensive. People won't pay for it as much, and the revolution in white wine making quality in the past 25 years is extraordinary. And so, whereas it used to be, well, you know, we'll drink some like simple Frascati, whatever
right.
it is. Now you see, even in what were thought of as simple regions and categories, there's extraordinary craft.
My point, you know, the value's there, the quality's amazing, and you would agree the diversity.
Unbelievable.
I mean, in Italy alone, in France, there's a zillion different white wines. You talk about wines in the book that over-deliver. Get a little specific with me. Tell me what you mean by over-deliver and give me some examples of, you know, wines that over-deliver.
Sure. Over-deliver simply being that the wine essentially outdrinks its price to our point about white wine.
Right, right.
And my quintessential example for this is Muscadet, which used to be this cheap, kind of no second thought white wine. You know, it's nice enough with oysters. This has been made in the far western Loire in France. And the level of winemaking that has risen there, in addition to probably 20, 25 years of work by the local appellation to do geological studies, to understand specific sub-regions and sub-terroirs in Muscadet, and the rise of organics, all of these things that are key to transforming a wine region have happened, and yet the wines are still $15, $18,
incredible,
if that. And
food friendly.
Yeah. And this
great
is,
producers now.
Yeah. And this is with a weak dollar. So you're like, well, here's this wine that, if you can get past what we used to think about it, has completely transformed itself. Same with Beaujolais, which has completely transformed itself.
Is Beaujolais itself the red that over-delivers? One of the reds?
It is. It's getting tougher because the best wines have gotten more expensive. But this Beaujolais was always the example. And the first time I was really writing about the changes in Muscadet, I said it's an imperfect analogy, but it's kind of the white wine equivalent to Beaujolais in that these are wines that just suffered from a bad reputation for too long.
Right. They've really come around. Places and regions worth exploring. I mean, we could probably do a show on that. But you get into a few places. So top of mind, off your head, you know, worth talking about, you know, what should people look towards?
You know, it always depends what you're looking for in wine. But I think the Loire Valley, that's not a surprise. That's always been...
That's where Muscadet comes from.
It is where Muscadet comes
from. Chenin Blanc.
Yeah, but it's you see that it's really moved out of the realm, like the Anjou, which was known for so long as this place for kind of cheap, sweet rosé. And, you know, as one producer there said, the 70s were basically fueled on Anjou rosé, on bad rosé from here. And it's now become the font of really interesting natural winemaking. But, you know, basic Bordeaux is coming back. I think if you look in regional Italy, you still see, I mean, there's still great Chianti being produced from organic farming producers. If you look for them, northern Italy, you find great Bartolino. You find great stuff out of northern Spain and Galicia. If you get kind of beyond the Rias Baixas Albarinos, and even there you find there's a step up in quality. You see Australia, which we not long ago were all making fun of for critter labels.
It's sort of come back, Australia.
Has revolutionized the same way that California did.
Right.
And so it's, you know, I think you see in a lot of quarters, except for the very few where there's a lot of economic pressure to against change, but even there,
what would be an example? Napa.
Napa's always the example,
right?
But Burgundy, and especially with the run of short vintages. I mean, I love Burgundy, and actually, it is a place that has truly transformed itself. But most people legitimately are not going to be able to find out because the wines are they're truly in short supply, and they have gotten expensive. But you know, there's I think everywhere you turn. Once you get past, you know, the flavor of the month thing that most wine writers occasionally, including myself, like to do, and you dig a little harder, I think, you know, Chile, which I hadn't really paid attention to for years, suddenly you're seeing all of this País and the Pipeño wines, this revival of the
different
old
than
classic.
Carmenier and Cabernet.
Yeah, and people seeing, you know, this is one of the oldest wine growing regions certainly in the New World, and people are going back with a sense of artisanship. So, you know, you can almost throw a dart at the map and find.
No, you mentioned 7, 8, 9, you know, interesting places, and I'll post that on our social media. One of the interesting things I thought you mentioned was that there are good finds and good values with wines that have fallen out of favor. So what is a wine that's fallen out of favor? I mean, it may be obvious, but tell me. And tell me a few, you know, that are good to look for.
I mean, Chianti is my perfect example where...
It used to be everybody would get it in
and
a restaurant.
Still, it's interesting because for all of the progress that Italy has made, it's possible to find really interesting Chianti. But, like, I think people face this question of, am I going to put this on my dinner table if I'm having friends over? I would because I don't care. And I like it and I'm happy to drink it. But I think that there are wines where people have a perception problem. I think White Zinfandel, there's this handful of people in California who essentially took the original idea of White Zinfandel, which was a high quality dry rosé, and decided to go back to that. What else? I mean, you know, Muscadet's not uncool anymore, but Merlot certainly still is. And it's interesting, we just did a bunch of Bordeaux tasting, and you find that there's a ton of really good right bank wines that are now, again, you see good farming, a lot of organic farming. You see not the kind of old, cheap industrial winemaking, but people really trying to make good, solid, unmessed with, largely Merlot, that even... after producing it, putting it on a boat, and getting it here, still is under $15 a bottle.
Which is crazy. We're talking to John Bonnet. John's new book is The New Wine Rules. I tried to wrestle with this question because you made a point that if wine is too cheap, it's not too good. And if you pay a certain amount, you know, you may overpay. And I think I got it where the sweet spot you sort of guided me to is somewhere around $20 for a reasonable wine. Is that fair? You know, why not less? Why not more?
I'd say 15 to 20.
15 to 20?
You know, it's something that we don't tend to think about in the U.S. because we're a little bit removed from the market. But, you know, the global variation of the dollar does have an impact on this. So what was, you know, $15 one year, maybe $17 the next year. And we expect that it's not going to change. And honestly, producers, mostly European producers, are under a lot of price pressure. But yeah, I think 15 to 20, and essentially what you see is
good quality wines.
Well,
good wines.
At 13 to 15, well, I mean, $8, $7, you're
stay
struggling.
Away. Right.
You can find good things. It's a challenge. You can. 10 to 15-ish is where a lot of the really industrial corporate wine lives. They've tried to push it up a little bit. Maybe they want a premium, et cetera. But if you think about, I mean, their suggested retail is higher, but if you think about what you're legitimately paying for, like a bottle of Kendall Jackson Chardonnay, that's kind of where it is. And so there's not a lot of purpose to competing in that realm. Whereas 15 to 20, it's a little bit more money, and it's where you see a lot of really talented producers either making basic wines from more well-known regions or making really very high-quality wines from lesser-known regions. And almost any really solid producer worth their salt outside of, again, like, you know, the Burgundians who somewhat painfully have had to make their basic wines more expensive, you see that there is that sweet spot, really, it's shocking, hasn't changed in probably almost a decade.
Really? Really? So I guess if you go into a good wine store that, you know, we talked about earlier, you know, one of their challenges, and I think their interest and love is to be able to turn you on to those wines in that price range. And earlier you had mentioned Muscadet, which is a terrific wine right in that price range. So the point is, you know, with all these hoity-toity wines and everything, you could drink some delicious and interesting wines in that price range.
And they want you to walk out with a bottle of wine for dinner that night. And I think they all retailers kind of know that, you know, if you'll spend maybe up to $20. If you're not going to spend more than $10, there's nothing to talk about.
Right.
But between 10 and 20, it's all a little bit fungible. And if they can make the case that you're going to have a great, great experience, I mean, this is my job, your job, everyone's job. If you can make the case someone's going to have a great experience for $18 instead of $14, then there is that portion of people who will take the lead.
You have most people's attention for $4 more if you could really turn them on to something interesting. All right, acidity. Acidity, you said, might be the most important quality in a wine. I mean, it's a pretty bold statement in a book.
Sure.
Why?
Well, people focus on flavors.
And this is fruity.
This is fruity. This tastes
not
like
even
cherries,
dry, sweet, but all those descriptors.
So it's this isn't even me. This is from years ago. I think this is a Lawrence Osborne book where he said, you know, how many red wines taste like cherries? All of them.
Okay.
So, you know, you look for the little curly cues that give you an indication as to why one wine is special or another. But in the macro sense, we do a lot of splitting hairs, and we don't talk really ever about acidity. And the reason, and having spent a portion of January doing dry January, it became very clear to me when I was trying to have dinner without wine. Acidity, and the reason people talk so much about having wine on the table is that acidity helps to clear and rebalance your palate. And acidity is legitimately, it is the most distinctive quality in a wine. And it is the one that, even if you're not picking up all the fruit flavors, you know, the fruit salad, you can tell if a wine has a lot of acidity or not much.
What would you tell people how they detect acidity? With white wine, to me, it's easier. You know, you feel it even more, you know, whether it's the little tingle or, I know I'm being base, but give me your...
I mean, the nice thing is that acidity is a quality that I feel like I don't even have to define, which is to say the same thing that your mouth does if you're tasting vinegar,
if you're
tasting fresh citrus.
You know it and you react to it in a way.
I mean, it's the reason that we squeeze lime into our soda.
Right.
Is
we want
more acidity and
vinegar with olive oil for a salad.
And it's, you know, look, there's a subset of people, possibly including the current leader of the free world, whose taste in beverages might be questionable, who will like drink a milkshake with a hamburger. But at some point you stop and you're like, you know, this actually isn't that pleasant. It's maybe nice as an indulgence, but in general, people like Coke with a hamburger, with pizza, with all sorts of
Coke's
things.
Coke's got a little acidity,
Coke's
right?
got quite a lot of acidity. It also has the other aspect, the other
which
thing
is
that
why
people,
it's so good with food.
Right. And yet it's where people obsess with Coke is the sugar. And it's funny because everyone's fine drinking a super sweet, incredibly high acid, like higher acid than most Rieslings drink when they go to McDonald's and they have a Big Mac. And yet if you put it into a wine context, these are things that seem to freak a lot of people out.
So I think it's an important quality, and I think people experience it but sometimes don't realize it, which is what sort of makes the wine, you know, good with food.
And it's something in cooking, honestly, that until really the past few years, people weren't talking a lot about the role of acidity in cooking as well. And yet it's the thing that really does balance a dish.
Yeah, I agree. This is a big subject, and I know we could probably spend a show on it, but I don't want to, but I need to talk to you about it because I know it's important to you. You talk about it in the book. And I guess the question is wide. I want your views on organic, biodynamic, and sort of the current wine movement. You don't have to explain what organic and, but it's really, the movement is really here. I mean, Brooklyn is, I always say, ground zero. You walk into any wine bar or wine store, it's basically natural. Tell me what's going on with that. You talk about it in the book.
Sure. I mean, you don't want to go too far in dictating the choices that people as farmers make in order to make a living, especially as some guy who lives in New York City. On the other hand, you know what? I kind of do, in that there is a certain relatively small section of subset of viticulturists, of people who are growing wine grapes, who have a case to be made that they just... the numbers don't work on using full organics. It's just not going to be sustainable. You can have a reasonable discussion about that in a very small number of cases, but in a much larger number of cases, there is no reason that people can't opt to essentially get rid of synthetics. And almost every argument that I have ever heard people make about why not to farm organically, biodynamics is a different thing. People want to opt in, that's
more
great.
More intense.
But, but certainly in terms of organics, I mean, we all understand why people opt for organic food instead
fruit
of
vegetable.
Conventional food. Right. And so You can have an internal debate with yourself as to whether you want to pay more for organic broccoli or not, but we're not talking about sustenance. I think you would be hard pressed to find someone whose calories in life come from wine. This is in one way or another, this is a small luxury. It's something that makes life better. And I think if people are going to make a choice about the level of farming that they want and the level of virtue in that farming, it's one thing to do it with food, and I think it's important generally to do it with food, but certainly with wine, if you're not at least thinking about it, then you're not completing the loop. And this was something I talked about in the California book, actually,
right.
Which is, you know, people go to a store like Whole Foods and they obsess about, you know, that it has to be, the beef has to be grass fed, the broccoli or the carrots or whatever have to be organic. And they go to the wine aisle and they just pick up the garbagiest, worst farmed wine there is,
right.
Because it's never been made clear that you have to make those conscious choices there as well. And I think be as much of a nudge about it if I didn't constantly, even today, hear people tell me that there are regions where you can't farm organically. There are too many obstacles. People are still saying this, for instance, in Champagne, where it is now probably 30, 40 years that people have farmed organically. They farm biodynamically. Roederer farms most of their vineyards biodynamically.
The big guys have changed over.
Yeah, so... So same in Bordeaux, you see someone like Latour, someone like Chateau Palmer now farming organically. Palmer's biodynamic, like legit biodynamic, and you're like, well, you know, if they
Rudolf
can do
Steiner biodynamic?
No, they're a little more flexible than hardcore Steiner, I think. But I believe they are certified, and I think it's one of those things where you're like, well, you know, if they can do it, and certainly they're not hurting for money, then why aren't their neighbors? Why isn't Lafitte? Why isn't Mouton? Why aren't these places that make a ton of money and have no obstacle to doing better, why are they still using the same arguments?
Right. Why are they not reinvesting? So that's point one. I mean, the first point is the farming should be done that way, but you could do that and then kind of screw it up in the cellar. So the next step is, you know, similar practices in the cellar, low intervention, no chemicals, no screwing around. Same thing, right?
Yeah, and again, I think it's important to understand winemakers' decisions in a context, which is to say, if I said no sulfur ever, no filtration ever, no acidification ever, no filtration ever, people like absolutes, but the difficulty is that there is reasonable decision making and there's a slippery slope. And, you know, I can forgive a lot of reasonable decision making when I understand the context of why someone might have done something that wasn't absolutely pristine and perfect. But it is from there a quick hop to the slippery slope of saying, you know what? We're chefs and we make reasonable decisions about how we want to guide the wine, and we need our full pantry of techniques to create the wine you want. And it's like, well, that's not what this is about. This was about you growing good grapes and making the wine that reflects the quality of what you picked. And, you know, it is much easier as a critic to believe in absolutes, but the absolutes are always fall through.
Right. So the movement is here. It's real. It continues to get bigger and more influential. And I think, to your point, more and more people who aren't will. And that's a good thing. Right?
Yeah. And again, I think, you know, and this goes to natural wine, this goes to a wide spectrum of things. To me, in some ways, it's less about saying this can never be that, than it is asking detailed, really specific questions about the process.
Right.
Because it's, again, it's all a little uncomfortable. And I think one of the reasons natural wine has really boomed is, like, people have finally gotten to a place, to my point about fear, where they're starting to feel confident enough that they want to ask those questions.
Right.
And that, you know, that is, it has many imperfect ways that it manifests itself, but the fact that the questions are there, to me, is so important.
Right. Let's change subjects. We're huge fans here at the Grape Nation for Champagne.
Everyone should be.
Right, which is why I want to talk about it a little. Peter Lean was just on at the end of the year. David White was on earlier in the year. Alice Payard came on, one of the few female winemakers. Whenever we do the wine list and talk to sommeliers and guests, Champagne comes up very often. You mentioned in the book that it's misunderstood, which we've talked about on this show. I mean, the biggest thing is it's celebratory. But why is it misunderstood, and you know, why should we pay more attention to Champagne?
I think Peter could answer that question better.
But you cover it in the book. To stay with the book, yeah, you know, it's a section.
Yeah. I think something that a lot of people have talked about, and this is the thesis of Peter's book, which is extraordinary. This was in here. This will be in the New French Wine. This is something I've talked about, other people have for a long time, is that, you know, it's not just growers, which are people who obviously are, you know, they're growing the champagne grapes that they then produce versus big houses. That's there. It's important, but you know, it's things have evolved beyond that debate. It's really that champagne, for the first time, maybe ever, is being considered as a wine, which is to say people see it's not just one big region. There are subregions, there are different expressions, there are different grapes. There are so many different ways to make it. And to my point about asking questions, that once you get beyond what champagne was until recently, which was, you know, mostly marketing hype, and you start digging in and you get past the thing of, well, we make appropriate decisions when blending because we want the style to be, I mean, all the
house
the complete crap that people have been pushing on us for years. You see that there is this extraordinary diversity in champagne unlike anything we've ever seen. And so, yeah, I mean, some of it is getting beyond celebration and realizing that it is a fun wine to drink. It's really lovely. It is, to my point about affordable luxuries, it is really something that you can get into for certainly under $50 and have, you know, a nice bit of pleasure added to
right.
your week, basically the cost of two movie tickets.
Right.
And
good point.
Yeah, and it's... and it's now something that you can legitimately see is coming from real people, not just from a brand. It comes from real people. It's made in real places, and you can explore the diversity of it. And that's something that, again, like was barely even talked about 15 years ago.
I think you made a good point. I mean, we all forget that champagne, the base of champagne is wine. And how it was treated, blended, house styles, you know, consistent taste through the years. There are a lot of people that go back to what we talked about, the farming practices, the blends now. You know, there's basically three grapes. I mean, Peter mentioned it too. The game in the last 10, 15 years, the transformation, you know, has been crazy. And people should look at it more that way. And like you said, yeah, it could still be a celebratory thing, and it's not expensive, and it's a luxury thing, but it's a different, better product now.
Yeah.
And it pairs well with food, which is a nice thing. We're going to take a quick break. I still have a bunch of questions for you. I think we may be able to squeeze in a second version of our wine list. So we're talking to John Bonnet, and we're talking about his new book, The New Wine Rules, and we'll be right back, and we're going to talk more about the book.
The following program has been brought to you by Tabard Inn. Tabard Inn, Washington, D.C.'s quintessential small hotel, is located on a quiet, tree-lined street just 5 blocks from the White House. Vibrant yet unassuming, the Tabard is comprised of 40 sleeping rooms, each unique in character and design. Feast on eclectic American cuisine in their acclaimed restaurant, or enjoy a cocktail and listen to live jazz in one of their cozy Victorian seating areas. Mingle with travelers from around the world who find the Tabard the only place to stay when taking their travels to Washington. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
We're back. We're back with my guest, John Bonnet, and we're talking about his new book, The New Wine Rules, which is currently... was just released at the end of last year. And John, it's available, I guess, everywhere. Amazon, yeah. Better bookstores. We'll remind people at the end of the show, too. There were two things I want to cover, and maybe we could jump into our wine list. One is wine and food pairing, which is one of my wine list questions. But you get into it pretty heavily. I think you have 4 rules on how you approach wine and food pairing. Let's go over them quickly. So again, people shouldn't be intimidated or have a fear, what do I do with wine and food? What's the best way to sort of demystify that?
I think the big rule was basically that, you know, yes, pairings are great. It's lovely if you find things that go together, but it's funny for a rule book to say this, obviously, but there have been built up all of these rules which may or may not work, but I think which over time have scared the hell out of people. And, you know, there's, as much as I like the notion that flavors can find a harmony, I also think that it needs to be said by educated wine people, by experts, that you know, don't worry about it. Drink a thing that you like. It might not be the thing that I would drink, but it doesn't matter what I would drink.
So screw the white wine and fish thing. Well, that's not a rule. It's fine, but...
In part because I can come up with 5-6 ways to disprove it, as I say in the book. You know, if you haven't had sushi with red burgundy, you've missed out.
Right.
The other thing, to me, this in some ways is almost the most important of the rules, is that... You know, wine pairing rules, as we talk about them, were essentially developed entirely out of Western and really Western European culture. And so, and by that, I mostly mean French and a little Spanish, a little Italian. So we talk about this as a thing that is done as though this entire universe of flavors and cuisines and cultures hasn't also come into our daily lives. And so, you try to talk about pairings, and the language that we have to talk about pairings in some ways has really been bound by a culture that is only a small portion of our overall culture now. And so you have to think in terms of how wine works with flavors that originated in cultures where they might not drink wine.
Right.
And I think when you think about that, when you think about the flexibility that you can and should have, this thing that, you know, was used to be what people did, which is you'd have a little pairing box next to a recipe and said, you know,
right.
you have to have a centimillion, or maybe you have to have this specific right. centimillion. I think it was driving people crazy.
Right. We shouldn't be so stuck to that. I think a good segue, because a wine and food pairing is a pretty common thing in restaurants. I think when you go out to eat, you usually look for good wine. You don't drink wine every night you cook at home. You get into wines and wine service at restaurants. And I think that fear and intimidation thing carries through, too, with big wine lists, sommeliers. So talk about... You know, how you should approach that when you get into a restaurant. You take a knock at, I wouldn't say a knock at sommeliers, but, you know, they're there to help you.
Yeah, I actually thought in the restaurant portion, I did my best to defend their
yeah,
honor and virtue.
That's my bad.
But I think
I read a separate article let's leave that behind. They're there to.
But I think. You reach a realization very quickly when you go to a restaurant,
which
as
is?
To whether the staff there, could be the sommelier, could be your server, could be a manager, whoever, whether they want to help you with your wine or not. And there are always going to be places where they're not trained enough, it's not the focus.
But do I know that as the consumer, or
I think you do. I think
you should be able to realize it's sort of like a good and a bad waiter.
Yeah. And this
guy's great, this guy sucks. Exactly. The wine guy has similar qualities.
Well, and it frankly might be your waiter. And it's one of those things where like I don't expect someone to have all the answers, but I expect someone in the restaurant to have all the answers. And I obviously am, you know, I'm kind of a wine nerd, and I'm a nitpicky, and I'm going to ask lots of questions. But someone who might not know a ton may still want to ask a lot of questions because they want to make a decision, and they shouldn't feel rushed, they shouldn't feel hounded, they shouldn't feel like someone's talking down to them. Man, there's a set of rules about your rights as a wine customer, and it's like restaurants in the U.S. typically charge twice the price of retail for a wine, and I don't have a problem with that, but for that money, I want someone to do their job, and their job is to help me find my path to pleasure when I'm looking for a wine in a restaurant. And if they can't do that, then they're not doing their job, and then I feel really angry about the fact that I'm paying twice what it costs. And I get what their economic realities are. I understand the economics of restaurants well enough to know, like, you know, you are supposed to pay more because you are getting more, but I expect to get it. And I think everyone, even if you don't know that much, should expect to get it. They should expect to be treated with respect.
Right. That's the job, and you should be guided properly.
Yeah. And that's not a sommelier thing. Like, again, that's...
Because not every restaurant has a sommelier.
Yeah, and a lot of them don't. So it's like, okay, I don't...
And have good wine lists.
Right.
And, even if it's one page.
Know, and a server may not know everything, you know. He may have shown up and, you know, he's still learning, but like someone in that place should know.
Right. All right. We're going to talk to Stephen Bitteroff from Riesling Fair in a couple of minutes. Vitor's going to get him on the line. Before we get to him, I want to subject John to our wine list. John had been on the show about a year ago and did one, so we're doing chapter two. This is the new wine rules version, all right?
Perfect.
So the first question then and now is, what are you drinking now? And that's what you're working on and what you're drinking through. And I'm going to make a guess and say French wines.
Yeah, a lot of French wine. I mean, like I said, it's been, you know, it's been a January to taper a little bit.
Right. That aside.
But, yeah, I mean, a lot of French wines. We just did some Bordeaux, and that was a pleasure revisit, because I spent about 3 weeks there last year. But to see the quality of what's there kind of under the radar, I mean,
Bordeaux drinking, not being the big expensive fancy, the fact that there's some good wines and some good value.
I mean, we just did a crib sheet for Punch that was where I think, I mean, everything.
Give
was
me one or two.
30. What did we love? I mean, we love the
just looked at it today.
Chateau de Chandetre, which is sort of way out at the outer edge, but it's property owned by a guy who used to work for Pontet-Canet, and I think it's $19.
Wow.
Give me one more. The Chateau Moulin de Tricot, which is one of Rosenthal's kind of really old school properties. They're in Margaux, but they also make an Omedoc, which is like unbelievably good for, I think, $28 or $29.
Incredible. So you can drink great Bordeaux.
Yeah.
I'll post those on our site. We talked about this just a few minutes ago. I think maybe you had to fine-tune it or hone it a little more. I asked you this question a year ago. Favorite wine and food pairing. Has it changed? Is it a tough question to answer? Has it always been the same?
Yeah, it's the problem of being omnivorous. I mean, what I mentioned just before was...
Omnivorous or carnivorous?
Omnivorous.
Okay.
No, because vegetables and wine is important, and it's sort of overlooked. I mean, the sushi and red Burgundy, as I mentioned.
That's a good one.
Yeah, I don't know what my last question, my last answer was.
I forgot to look it up.
But one that I mentioned in the book that I always adore is a lot of both Sichuan and Shanxi cooking, where obviously using Sichuan peppercorns, but also
spicy.
Using a lot of chili, but using it in a very sort of smoky way. It's a lot of kind of dry cooking with Cabernet Franc.
Right. Because of the spiciness in Cabernet Franc,
too. Yeah, and it's just, and again, to my point that there's cuisines that don't intrinsically have wine as part of their culture, that there are wines that go beautifully with.
Right, good ones. Some restaurants, this was one of the questions, but it's revised a little. Some restaurants that do all things wine well, so their focus is on wine. Can you name a few favorites in New York, or, you know, that really stand out as far as selection,
sure,
service, price?
I mean, some things that I love right now. I love known to Heritage Radio folks. I love what Joe Campanelli is doing at Fausto.
Yes.
I feel like he's found this great way to take like his own interests, a little bit of natural, a lot of Italian, and find this perfect balance. We spend a lot of time at Marta and now at Vignier Fridi because the champagnes are so
sparkling,
well priced.
The champagne,
and it's just this perfect way to our discussion about exploring champagne.
Yep.
To get
and
there.
Reasonable stuff too.
Exactly. I love some of the expansion of Terroirs List right now, there was somewhere else that I was just looking at, and I'm blanking on it. So
our friend Kimberly went over to Scampi. Mm-hmm. And has an interesting list. I'll throw that one in.
Yeah.
Those are good ones. I'll list those. Right now, favorite wine region? It's not the Loire, is it?
I drink a lot of Loire.
Right now, not all time. And, you know, you'll come back for the new French wine.
Yeah,
it'll
exactly
be different. But what would you say right now?
I mean, right now, it's probably between the Loire and Champagne, and some of it is just getting to revisit those a little bit. Champagne had a couple weird vintages, and now like the 12, 13, 14 base vintages are so good.
12, 13, 14 in Champagne, because 11 sucked, right? Yeah.
11 sucked, but now we're into like a lot of 12 base wines.
Good stuff.
So good.
Okay. All right, we asked you this question last time, and we sort of broached it a little, but let's get specific. best wine around $15, $15 to $20. Give me a white, give me a red. You can go category, you can go specifics, you can go both. You got into the book a little.
Yeah, know. I mean, white, I'm gonna fall back on Muscadet.
Muscadet, we're already good talking answer. About give it. Me a couple of makers that you like.
In that realm, I mean, Marc Olivier is always amazing. Right. Luno Pepin, really, I mean, the quality they do, you could easily outdrink Chablis, like Grand Cru Chablis, with some of their wines.
Right.
And red wine, I mean, if you look at Saumur Champigny, I think has overtaken.
Saumur is Loire?
Is Central Loire.
S-A-U-M-U-R. One M?
One M.
All right, so Saumur wines.
Kind of it's suburbs, places like Notre Dame, Depuy, where it's different than Chinon Bourgogne, but right. It's still really interesting Cabernet Franc.
Right, so those are good ones. All right, John, sit here for a minute with me. I'm going to get Steven Bitteroff on the phone. Steven owns Von Boden, which is a German wine importer, and he is also the founder of Riesling Fair, however you pronounce it, he'll tell me, which is an event coming up in New York. Vitor, do we have Steven on the line?
Yep, I'm here.
Steven, hey, how are you, man? We finally got this together. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for your patience. Yeah, it's like to be here. Hey, John.
Hey, how are you?
I was just going to say hello to John.
I should have said Riesling.
Yes. Riesling's always a good answer.
I was listening.
All right, so I wanted to get you on because I know you're passionate about German wines, Riesling. You've launched Riesling. How do you pronounce it? Fire. So Riesling Fire. Yeah. Quickly tell us what Riesling Fire is and how it came about.
Yeah, for sure. It was, you know, I mean, it's kind of unabashedly aping Daniel Jonas's La Palais, which, you know, is an American version of a French kind of harvest celebration that's happened. And the idea was really just to get, to get people who love German wines. And at this point, it's expanded to kind of include the whole Teutonic sphere in there. So this year we have Jean Trimbach coming. So Alsace will hopefully become a bigger and bigger part of it. Last year, there are a number of Austrians there. So it's kind of Austria, Germany, Alsace, you know, the sort of
right. It's expanded
the origin, the homeland of Riesling, as it were. And it really was just an idea to get a bunch of people together in a room who really love these wines. I think they have, you know, I think to some extent, this region of the world in these wines, because of their specificity and the vineyard detail and all this stuff, they attract the geeks in the same way I think Burgundy did
right.
20 years ago. Not that it doesn't now, but also attracts different people as well with different motives. So I think it's that same sort of, you know, love of the details and the, you know, the kind of desire to get together with people who also have this kind of addiction, illness, passion.
Right. So the fair takes place January, what's the date?
Yeah, it's Saturday, January 27th.
Which is coming up.
And every year, it's different producers, different events.
Let's talk about the events.
Travel schedules and everything. It is only Saturday, January 27th, and there's really two big events. One is the gala dinner, which is a kind of fancy sit-down dinner, you know, with five courses, and all the growers are attending, and they bring kind of fancy bottles from their cellars, and all the guests do as well, and it's just a sort of bacchanalian dinner that's a lot of fun.
So the guests bring wine.
We're, you know, what's that?
The guests bring wine. Plus,
the guests bring wine.
Plus, you
the winemakers
wine.
Bring wine.
Right.
I mean, it's over the top.
Like
I had the first year we did it, which was 2013. You know, there were a number of growers, but Katerina Prum from JJ Prum and Klaus-Peter Keller were both there, who have, you know, had at this point really long careers. And at that point, had long careers and had drank a lot of wine. And both of them said to me that night they had never been in a room with
right.
so much kind of historic
right.
German wine in the room. So it's a really fun kind of indulgent evening. And then the other event is called the Grand Tasting. And that really is, you know, it's trying to get to, for people who don't want to spend $300 and bring a fancy bottle of wine and don't want to sit down for a long meal, but really, you know, either one, want to taste the wines, want to get to know the growers, and or want to kind of learn about German wines and what kind of Riesling can be. It's a $33 ticket that gets you in the door to taste with 14 growers, you know, be somewhere between 40 and 50 wines. And that's going to take place during the afternoon, just Saturday, January 27th at Kraft. So, kind of right in the middle.
That sounds like a good deal.
In the middle of Manhattan. And it's just a great way to kind of, you know, either either meet the growers and taste the wines for the 10th time, or to do it for the first time.
So that's a walk around. So you can walk around different tables, different growers. A lot of the growers are going to be there. You're focusing on the 2016 vintage, right?
Exactly right. Yep. Yes. And every single Riesling Fire grower will be there.
Right. Do we still have Stephen on the line? You there, Stephen? Uh-oh, technical difficulties. All right, we're going to call him back. We'll get him back on the line, but now's a good time to ask John, who is still sitting here. John, if we want to get the book, and we mentioned this earlier, but I want to be official about it, Amazon?
Amazon is great. Barnes & Noble is great. In your local independent bookseller.
Have you gotten good participation?
We have.
From, you know, booksellers and
we
all
have.
That.
It was interesting to look at the numbers, and whereas what they call online was, I think, a much bigger portion of what the New California did. And online doesn't mean like BarnesandNoble.com.
Right.
It means Amazon. People were only online.
Right.
This time we had a lot of pickup from the bookstores, and I think that's great. And I mean, I'm not, you know, it's not to be obvious about it, but we designed the book to be something that people could kind of browse and pick up, and that you know, wasn't kind of hidden away on the culinary shelf, but that would be interesting enough that someone could get into it without feeling like they had to be a wine geek.
Now, have you and are you hitting the road promoting?
A tiny bit so far.
You've done it.
We're easing into it. In fact, I have to start sorting that out. I think in the spring we're going to try to get out on the road, get to the West Coast. But also I really want to get to some cities in the Midwest. I've talked to a number of folks, and I think, you know, I mean,
hit certain markets.
Well,
touch those markets.
You know, New York is awesome. You know, sure, we'll be in LA and San Francisco, but I also think there's a lot of places where, you know, frankly, wine writers, you know, are a slightly travel. I wouldn't say travel averse. We don't get out of our zone too often. So I feel like it would be good to get out a little farther and really get to some of the interesting booksellers, the interesting restaurants that are out there. I mean, like Minneapolis, I've been super excited to go to three or four places.
Yeah, it's
there.
A good market.
And
it's funny you say you're travel averse because for research and, you know, for the base of the books, you travel your ass off.
We go everywhere that there's vines, but when it comes to everywhere
people.
Else, it's weird how we don't seem to wander very far.
People. Vitor, do we have Stephen back on the line?
Yes, I'm back. Sorry about that.
You bastard, you hung up on me. Remind me of this when I see you, all right? Don't worry about it. All right, let's finish up. So we have Riesling Fire, January 27th, right? That's a Saturday.
Yep.
There's the gala dinner, and there's a walk-around tasting. You said the dinner sold out. Are there a few tickets left for the tastings?
There are. So the way we do the tasting, just to make it kind of as manageable and kind of not crowded as possible, is we sell tickets for different sessions. So the first three sessions are sold out, so that's from 10:30 in the morning. For some reason, that's always the one that sells out first.
I think people think they have to get there early.
It's, you know, Riesling is the breakfast wine. So we have tickets available for the third session, which is 1:30 to 2:30 on Saturday, January 27th. And as I said, tickets are $33, and that's, you know, every single Riesling Fire grower will be there. So there's 14 this year,
right?
And focusing mostly on the 2016 vintage, but, you know, there are often some surprises.
All right, before I let you go. Two things. The first thing is, when did your obsession with these Teutonic wines start, and how?
When did it, you know, probably, right, honestly, right at the beginning of my drinking career, which was, you know.
Jumped right into it?
Was something, you know, in the late 90s. And the reason was, you know, because one, they're affordable. Two, there's just so much versatility, and there's such a broad spectrum. You know, and it's with kind of everything. I think the deeper it goes, kind of the more fun it is. So there's just a lot to learn.
Right.
And so, you know, so it was kind of right from the beginning. And it was as a consumer, it was just like shopping around, trying to find good wine for the dollar. You know, good wine, good values. Right. And then, you know, there's just such a culture. There's such a history behind it. There's so many details. There's so much to learn, and that kind of fueled the fire, and it's, you know, still burning bright.
I'd hate to be a Merlot drinker on a life raft with you and Paul Greco. I'll tell you that much.
you would have plenty of Merlot to drink.
Right. Yeah, I'd probably get chucked up. All right, Stephen, one last thing. If anybody wants more information on Riesling Fire, it's RIESLINGFEIER. That's the spelling. What's the site for people?
Yeah, so the site is that. So it's, you know, the grape Riesling. And then fire is, as you said, FEIER.
Right.
And that's like it's a slightly more formal word for celebration. You know, you have Oktoberfest, which is, you know, the party. Fire is a little bit more the celebration. So the website is just that, www.rieslingfire.com. Obviously on Twitter and Instagram and, you know, all those social media pages. But, you know, if you Google Riesling Festival, Riesling Fire, you'll probably find us.
All right. And you are also, what would you say, an importer, distributor of importer of a lot of fine German and more winemakers, which is a nice thing. Yeah. So you're totally engrossed in this. Exactly. I want to thank you for coming on. I wanted to give a little shout out to the fair because I'm also a big Riesling fan.
Awesome. So we
hope to see you there, and good luck with everything. And thank you for jumping on.
Cool. Thank you very much, Sam. I appreciate the time and the effort. Yep. Yeah. So spread the good word, and, you know, my last message is just bring Riesling to bring German wines to dinner parties. That's the way to do it, because the people who know the specialists, they're the ones who need to convince people. Because when people drink the wines and they don't know their German wines, they love them. There's just such a strong bias against, you know, conceptions of what they think the wines are. So
no, you're right.
I want to make a bumper sticker. Bring Riesling to dinner parties.
We're not there yet. That's why we got to keep promoting this. So
exactly.
All right. Thanks, Stephen. See you soon.
Thanks so much, guys. Have a great one. Thanks, John.
You too.
Thanks. All right. We're going to wrap up soon, but I wanted to ask John one more question. And the question is, you have used the word new in all your books, okay?
Weirdly so.
Yeah. So I think you probably have a definition. In your mind, what is the new wine? I think you got into it with California. I think you're going to unravel it with France. And I think you approach this book. But what's John Benet's new wine?
So when I started writing with Punch, we set out a first column in which we knew we needed to sort of reset the parameters. And so I wrote a column about what I called the new mainstream. And the new mainstream is basically there is no mainstream. Everything is so subdivided and diverse and really different and changing and evolving that you can't say, well, these are the old wines and these are the new wines, because you find these very traditional old wine regions. We've talked about a ton of them. Could be Chianti, could be Piedmont, could be the Loire, Bordeaux, wherever, that we think of as old, but in fact the changes that are there and the rate of change is so astonishingly fast. And that was the lesson that I got in California, where everyone thought California was kind of a little old and tired, and yet it was under this, in the midst of this transformative revolution. And so I think the new wine is something that can happen anywhere. It's a matter of simply realizing that wine has a very long tail of memory and reputation. People think about what used to be, and wine itself, which is when you go out in the field, you go in the cellars, wine moves much faster. And so the new is, of course, very convenient to use in a title. But it basically is looking at what is coming next, what is on the horizon at change. And that's important, and it's important to understand that things aren't as set in stone as we'd like them to be.
Right. You are currently working on the new French wine.
I am.
I talked to you earlier about this. I thought maybe it was coming out this year, but it'll be out sometime in 2019.
It will be out fall 2019.
Okay.
For a variety of reasons, but there's a lot of France to cover.
Would you come back on and talk about that book?
I would love to.
All right. If you have a question, wine happening or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Follow us on Facebook at The Grape Nation. We'll list a lot of the wines that John talked about on our Facebook page on the site. You can follow us on Instagram at SBenRuby and at #TheGrapeNation. You now can follow hashtags on Instagram, and we have two sites, SBenRuby and The Grape Nation. On Twitter, at BenRuby. John, we talked about where we can get the book. It's readily available. And where can we follow you? Because you're all over the place, and it's fun to follow you on social media.
Yeah. You could always find many of my articles, not all of them, at punchdrink.com.
Right, we didn't talk about that much.
That's all right.
Punch.
Punchdrink.com.
Punchdrink.com.
You can find me on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Jay Bonet.
At Jay Bonet. I've been scanning through Punch the last week just to catch up and also to prepare. I mean, the frequency of how much you write, what you write about, I mean, you could pretty much stay in the game if you just followed John about what's going on, trends. He talks about 2017. He talks about 2018. He gets specific with a lot of wines. He talks about Cabernets, Bordeaux, their selections. So it really is a wealth of information. There's great perspective. And there's incredible frequency, and not to the point where, you know, it wears thin or this guy's saying the same thing over. It's really great stuff, and, you know, I recommend people to go there. All right, we want to thank our guest, John Bonet. Thank you to our engineer, Vitor, and everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. Also, thanks to Stephen Bitteroff for calling in for a couple of minutes to talk about Riesling Fair coming up in New York City on January 27th. I'm Sam BenRuby, and you have been listening to The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.